and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the emergence of the junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, as the head of the Stop Trump movement and the possible GOP standard bearer following his big victory over Trump in the Wisconsin primary. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas and author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, joins us to discuss how the self-declared Washington outsider is now the Republican establishment's best hope to stop Trump. We will assess Cruz's chances of beating either Sanders or Clinton, and whether, after a bruising convention, Cruz could, as he just promised, unite the party, given his extreme right-wing Tea Party political stance and his toxic unpopularity with his GOP senatorial colleagues, many of whom feel Cruz will be as devastating to their down-ballot chances as Trump would be. Then we'll examine the Department of Labor's new retirement fiduciary rules announced today requiring financial brokers dealing with IRAs and 401k retirement funds that receive tax advantages to prioritize their clients' interests over their own financial gain. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch, joins us to discuss these new protections for extremely vulnerable investors who lose an estimated $17 billion every year in hidden fees and sales commissions from financial advisors who are either self-serving, unscrupulous, or both. Then finally, we'll look into the sentencing today of the coal baron Donald Blankenship to a year in prison for the deaths of 29 men killed in a blast at Blankenship's Upper Big Branch mine 6 years ago that was the result of his willful violation of mine safety standards. Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, joins us to discuss the sad truth that, although the coal baron got off lightly and will appeal, it is the first time that any mine owner has been held responsible for the deaths of miners. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He is the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Oh, great to be back with you, Ian.
And so what's happening with the the junior senator? I must say this guy's ambition is pretty extraordinary. A junior senator that absolutely infuriated his colleagues in the Republican caucus in the Senate. And he runs for president. And because he's the least worst option, now he's the great white hope for the Republican Party.
Kind of funny that a person with at least partial Hispanic heritage is, as you point out, the great white hope, and that's true both metaphorically and I think quite literally. You know, there's a kind of narrative about Ted Cruz that we've settled into that, from my reading and research, is pretty accurate. He was an obnoxious person from the earliest anyone can recollect. He tried to get into Republican politics in D.C. He tried to kind of worm his way into the Bush administration. And as you point out, people don't tend to like Ted Cruz when they get to know him. So his career in Washington was going nowhere. He came back to Texas. He was Solicitor General of Texas from 2003 to 2008. Not a terribly high-profile office, but he helped make it a high-profile office by filing suits against the Obama administration, that brought up this sort of conservative bases, you know, red meat politics. He surprised people in 2012 when he beat the sitting lieutenant governor for an open U.S. Senate seat and defeated that sitting lieutenant governor pretty handily. He got 57% of the vote in the Republican primary. And, of course, remember, for those in California, that the Republican primary is equivalent to the general election for statewide offices in Texas, since every office in the state is held by a Republican. So that's Ted Cruz, not well-liked in the Senate, not well-liked by people in Texas, not well-liked anywhere. How did he become the hope of the Republican Party? That's a pretty strange story this year.
So how did he get elected then? I mean, was it an off-year election? I take it was.
No, there was an open U.S. Senate seat. A moderate Republican, by contemporary terms, Kay Bailey Hutchison, decided not to pursue another term. And so there was an open Senate seat. It was assumed it would go to this sitting Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst. But remember, this was the surge of the Tea Party still going strong. And Ted Cruz, always the opportunist, saw a moment to go after this sitting Lieutenant Governor, who was not a particularly good campaigner. He was a rich guy who many people thought was too moderate, even though, you know, he's a right-wing Republican. So you got to remember, we're in Texas, where everything is skewed so far to the right, it's kind of hard to describe to people who aren't here. And Cruz very skillfully used the weaknesses of that lieutenant governor, appealed to that red meat base of the Republican Party, and won fairly handily. He didn't come in first in the first round. It was in the runoff that he really went after Dewhurst. And that's where he proved his skill rhetorically. Now, people who are actually looking for content and trying to find logical arguments and such things might not think of Ted Cruz as a great rhetorician. But when he's talking to Republicans, when he's talking to that extreme conservative base in a state like Texas, he plays fairly well. And he's done well in other parts of the country where that is the core of the Republican electorate.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, who's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Well, the one thing I recall about Ted Cruz is when he first arrived on the scene during the confirmation hearings for a fellow Republican who had been named as the Obama had named as Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel.
Yeah.
He brought up the most outrageously McCarthyite attack on Hagel, suggesting that Hagel had taken money from the North Koreans. And this came up in his hearing. There was no basis to it. There was no substance to it. It just was completely made up out of thin air. And it was the most outrageous example of McCarthyism, where you're guilty until proven innocent. This guy is a really bad actor.
I would agree, and a lot of people in Texas would agree. Even Republicans in Texas would agree. Just like Ted Cruz is not popular in U.S. Senate circles in the GOP, just as he's not popular in Washington, D.C. more generally, he's also not terribly popular with kind of the Republican Party machinery down here. Journalists are stunned. I've talked to several journalists in recent days who tell me that from the moment people meet Ted Cruz, there's a kind of visceral response to the kind of sleaziness that you're talking about. Now, you know, that's Ted Cruz, the person, the opportunist, the careerist. But let's not forget that this is also a reflection on the general political culture we live in, that maybe 10 years ago it would have been hard to make the kind of wild accusations you're talking about. But it does feel like a kind of political free-for-all out there. And there's all these, you know, political fact-checking websites. There's journalists covering this. But there is a sense, maybe it's, you know, the ultimate politics as reality TV, that it doesn't really matter what you say, that if your base likes you, even if it's demonstrated that you're telling, you know, out and out lies, that you won't alienate your base. Now, certainly Donald Trump has proved this, but I think you're right to point out that Ted Cruz is very much like Donald Trump in that way. He's not as, you know, as much of a caricature in a sense. You know, he's got a much more reputable hairdo, perhaps. But in rhetorical style, all of this obsession with Donald Trump and his overt racism and his xenophobia, all of which is appropriate, has, I think, obscured the fact that Ted Cruz, as you're pointing out, is every bit as dangerous. And in some ways, perhaps more dangerous if he were actually in office, because the buffoonery of Donald Trump has limits, but Ted Cruz is a much scarier individual. I agree completely.
Well, there are a number of political analysts, who think that not just the Republican majority in the Senate, but in the House itself could be in play, with not just Trump's nomination, which has been their great fear, the down ballot damage that Trump would do, but they also feel that this could happen with Cruz. Part of me thinks that maybe Cruz is a part of a bigger scenario where he's the guy that the designated hitter that gets rid of Trump. And then because it's such a mess at the convention, then Paul Ryan rides into the rescue.
Well, this will not shock you, Ian, but I'm not privy to the secret strategy of the Republican insiders.
Nor am I.
But I think you're right to identify a couple of things. One is that whether it's Trump or Cruz at the head of the ticket, it's going to be a disaster for Republicans down ballot. The Republicans are certainly going to lose seats in the House, whether the House is in play or not. I'm not enough of a poll watcher to know. The Senate certainly might be up for grabs if the Republican presidential nominee went seriously off the rails. Also remember that the likely Democratic Party nominee is going to be Hillary Clinton. And Hillary Clinton's unfavorable rating, her negatives, are also substantial. And whatever happens in the Republican convention, you can be pretty sure that the Republican nominee is going to spend most of their time going after Hillary Clinton. And the I think, really unfortunate part of that is that the entire election campaign is going to probably reach new levels of depravity. There's going to be virtually no talk about serious issues. I fear that the issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up now are going to be washed away in this, again, kind of politics as the ultimate reality TV show. I think a lot of people in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, or even Democrats more generally, might be thinking to themselves, the Republicans are destroying themselves. That's a good result. But there's damage to the body politic here that I don't think we should overlook. A degradation of the political dialogue, and you might say, well, how much more degraded could it get? But I think we might see new lows in the general election campaign. So there are lots of reasons to be worried. The election of a Republican president in 2016 seems pretty far-fetched at this point. The polls that are being done suggest that, you and I running on the Democratic Party ticket could probably beat almost any Republican at this point. And if you want to throw your hat in the ring, Ian, I'd be happy to be your running mate.
I think I prefer to be the piano player in the whorehouse, if you don't mind.
All right. Well, I think, on Democracy Now! This morning, Van Jones made this point that we shouldn't be encouraging this. Whatever our political position, whether we consider ourselves within or outside the Democratic Party, whether we think of ourselves as liberal, progressive, or radical, that those of us who care about the future should not be kind of chuckling about the Republican situation. As someone who lives in Texas and has lived in Texas for 24 years, I've seen a right-wing state move dramatically further to the right. I've seen politicians elected to statewide office in this state of Texas who are actually more comical, in a sense, than Donald Trump. We have an attorney general, a Tea Party, far-right conservative attorney general, who's currently under indictment for securities fraud, and yet continues to, pursue the most outlandish kind of politics. We have a commissioner of agriculture who sends around photoshopped pictures of Barack Obama and doesn't bother to apologize when it's revealed he's engaged in passing along fraudulent images. I live in Texas, and I see how crazy it can get and how politicians who feel emboldened by this degraded public dialogue keep going no matter how many reputable news agencies or you know, other people point out the flaws in their argument, the distortions in their facts, or in some cases, the out-and-out fraud they're committing. So if you're tempted to chuckle at the Republicans, folks out there in California, I would say, come for the weekend and visit me in Texas, and you'll be scared.
Well, right there on your own campus, Robert Jensen, the University of Texas, they have an open carry law now where students can carry guns openly. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, if you were grading their papers and one of your students didn't like the results, what's to stop him from pulling
it? Okay, Ian, I get the implied threat. I'll give you an A. An A on this interview, Ian, I promise. Actually, just to clarify the insanity of Texas, the law that was passed to authorize students to carry guns on campus is for concealed handguns only. So if a student
Oh, it's not open carry. Oh, that's even worse, though.
Well, that's not good, but you're confusing. We also now have a new open carry law statewide.
Right.
So if you're walking around on the streets of Austin, you can carry openly a handgun. But if you want to come on campus, you have to tuck it underneath your jacket. So, you know, if you come to Texas to visit, Ian, and you're strapped, I'm just giving you some heads up there on the law, okay?
I see. Well, but, you know, one of the things that's potentially quite scary about the Republican convention in Cleveland that many think will be a kind of bloodbath, already the NRA types have tried to force the RNC to allow them to be able to carry guns on the conventional floor. And, of course, the Secret Service said no to that. But Ohio is an open carry state. And Corey Lewandowski, who is Trump's campaign manager, who has been in trouble for manhandling a woman, he came to fame in New Hampshire by organizing a rally where everybody showed up with assault rifles. So if they screw with Trump, which they are by definition going to do, trying to use Trump as the stalking, trying to use Cruz as the stalking horse to blunt Trump's momentum, and if Trump has promised that if he's not treated fairly, he's going to be upset, he doesn't probably have the ability now to get on all the ballots to run as a third party because the filing dates are too late. But he could cause a ruckus, and if his people are outside with their assault rifles, you know, in an open carry state, that seems like a pretty incendiary situation.
Well, it certainly is. And you know, there's a lot of comparisons being made to Weimar Germany, that, you know, the F word comes up, fascism. And I think this is one of those things where we have to be careful when we make comparisons. So certainly violence is possible. I mean, this is a very violent country. It's a country awash in guns. It's a country in which Donald Trump now has legitimated anger, independent of a careful analysis of why one may be angry. It doesn't matter. You can just, if you're angry, that is its own legitimation. And as you're pointing out, that's a recipe for random violence. But I think sometimes friends of mine sort of overdraw the conclusions to fascism. Remember, in fascism, you had armed gangs that were an integral part of the political scene, that were out in the streets doing battle. And we're not at that point yet. We don't have, you know, Republican Party militias authorized by the party doing battle with other parties' militias. So it's a different kind of violence that's possible, but it's certainly possible. It's certainly worth being concerned about. And what one does about it at this point, when one thinks about the number of guns in this country and when one thinks about the political rhetoric that we can no longer escape in this particular election cycle, I'm not planning to vacation in Cleveland. Let's just put it that way.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, and don't forget that offer to come down to Texas is always open, Ian.
Well, yeah, but I would have to pick up a gun, as I guess, down there. At least here in California, you can't arm yourself quite so easily. So I'll think about it, okay?
Sounds good.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the new rules from the Labor Department about ending retirement rip-offs. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bartlett Naylor, a financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bartlett Naylor.
It's an honor to be with you, Ian.
And thank you, Bartlett. And you were in at the announcement today of the new Labor Department rules on overseeing, stopping financial advisors from misleading Americans' savings for retirement. And I take it was a pretty big event. This is the Secretary of Labor, of course, is being considered, I believe, as a possible running mate for Hillary Clinton. But who was there when this announcement was made?
Yes, and I'm happy to run through the list, which includes Senator Elizabeth Warren, as you said, Secretary Perez listed as a possible Hillary Clinton vice presidential possibility. In fact, the venue itself was the Center for American Progress, which is viewed as sort of a holding tank for people that that might wind up in a year in a Hillary Clinton administration. There were a number of congressmen. Senator Cory Booker was quite a cast, and I think that pageantry was certainly intentional because in Washington, on financial issues, this has been the most intensely fought battle. And Wall Street has fought very expensively to stop this. So I think the president and others in favor of the rule wanted to show a major force is behind this. This fight isn't over, even though the rule is final. Then we can certainly talk about Wall Street's next move. But I think this was a show of force, just like, you know, in the old military, you show up all your troops. You hope you don't have to actually fire shots, but here are your guns. Here they are.
Well, but this rule was first, new rule was first proposed in 2010, and then the Department of Labor withdrew it in 2011 because of criticism from Wall Street and the financial industry and their congresspeople that they own. And then a modified version was presented in 2015, and it was also met with a blizzard of criticism. So the thing that I don't understand is, given that an estimated $17 billion a year is basically fleeced from retirees with all these hidden fees and sales commissions that these unscrupulous financial advisors are able to get away with, who's in favor of ripping off retirees? I mean, what a position to take.
Yes. Well, in a town where cynicism, where now even the House of Cards, Frank Underwood, apparently is not considered enough realism. The argument on Wall Street side is quite preposterous. But it's this: that unless these broker dealers are not beholden to a best interest standard, they will just disappear. In other words, if they can't scam you just a little bit, they won't service you at all. And apparently that argument sells enough that it's gotten both houses of Congress to pass bills to basically override this Department of Labor rule. Fortunately, the president has the veto pen, and he has stopped that. But it is a preposterous argument, but Washington is run by Republicans, and they are repeating the Wall Street line.
So will they repeat the Wall Street line with these new rules then? I mean,
well, the new rules are good. A public citizen is a pretty perfectionist organization, and we assume that we will not be perfectly pleased with what comes out. And as the rule was finalized today, the actual text will not become public until Friday. For example, I spoke with a DOL official, Tim Hauser, who is one of the key draftsmen, and he acknowledged that there will be mandatory arbitration. That means when you do have a problem when you're broker, when you do sort of discover, because your smart uncle Maury tells you that, in fact, looking at your statement, there was something that they should have sold you. In fact, they sold you this high commission product. You can't sue them. You will be forced to go into mandatory arbitration, which is a second-rate, junior varsity version of a judicial response, and we think that's bad. You will be allowed to join into a class action lawsuit. That's if the brokerage firm is ritually screwing consumers. But if your particular broker just screwed you, unfortunately, you cannot achieve justice in courts under this new rule.
So the rule, the Department of Labor, having finalized these rules are the law of the land? Is that what you're telling us?
That's right. That's right. These rules, Congress passes a law. This case, it was a 1974 law, and agencies interpret that law into rules which are kind of like speed limits on the highway. Mm-hmm. The law says drive safely, and then a local agency says, well, safely means 65 around this corner, 65 on the straightaway. And that's what the Department of Labor has done. It's updated it because, in fact, the landscape has changed so dramatically since 1974, when many Americans were on so-called defined benefit plans, where we kind of had retirement, done for us because we worked for a company all our careers, to basically coming up with our own retirement funds through IRAs and 401ks. But that makes us vulnerable, each of us individually, to brokers who can, take us for a ride, who can put their own interests and commissions, and, we're all trying to make money, ahead of actually our best interest. Doctors, lawyers, they're supposed to deal with your best interest. Brokers, however, do not necessarily have to actually serve your best interest. They can sell you a product that makes them a little bit more money at your expense.
Again, I'm speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's a financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he served as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. So, albeit that these rules have been watered down, just to go through them briefly, financial brokers must now act as clients' best interest when giving retirement investment advice. This is tougher than a previous standard in which they had to ensure products were suitable for clients. So that's obviously an improvement. Firms must
make it's only one class of customer, and that is a customer who has an IRA or a 401k, both of which are tax advantaged. If this just is your normal brokerage account, the Wild West rules still prevail. In other words, your broker can only, he's only limited to promoting something that's suitable. It can be something that generates a better commission to him or her at your expense.
And another rule change: firms must ban financial incentives for advertisers not to act in the client's best interest. Well, the fact that you have to even have a rule like that sounds is extraordinary to my mind.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're all very excited because we won, and it's a hard fought victory. But when you step back and rise to 30,000 feet, you have to entertain the defeatist attitude that, you know, if this is the victory, we really got problems here in dealing with Wall Street.
Firms must disclose compensation arrangements on a web page and by making sure customers are aware of their right to all fee information. Well, that seems like a very helpful move.
That's certainly welcome. I think that it will be in the implementation. In other words, if an enterprising customer wants to find out now, she can. So it will be interesting to see if it says right out in front of the sale thing. My object is to get as much money out of you as possible. So please understand that when I'm about to sell you a product. we hope it's as blunt as that, but I assume that having gone to, you know, Ivy schools, they will learn euphemisms that will be put them on page 17.
The rule allows firms and advisors to continue receiving the most common forms of compensation for offering investment advice to retail customers and small plan sponsors. The rule also does not limit the types of assets they can invest in, and firms are allowed to sell insurance products like variable and indexed annuities under the best interest rule. Just jump in whenever you want to clarify anything. The rule clarifies treatment of small businesses that sponsor 401k plans, allowing bankers to sell products and services to them. And the rule allows firms and their advisors to recommend proprietary products. That doesn't seem like an improvement, does it?
Well, yeah, no. You're ruining my night, Ian, because I was trying to celebrate this, but now all these details are like, oh, God.
Right.
Yeah, so variable annuity is about seven syllables that spell danger. It's a product that I'm sure is worthwhile in certain situations, but there are enormous management fees that the typical customer can't possibly understand. And, you know, I don't know why. Well, I do know why we have all these complicated products is because in the complication is where the muggers hide that are trying to get our money.
Right.
I would say that anything that comes out of Washington right now that succeeds is the subject of enormous compromise and kind of like temperature or kind of like cloud formation. It happens when enough of the electrons on one side and the protons on the other side are such that it exists. So it's not like the good guys beat the bad guys. It's that enough good guys made compromise with enough bad guys that this is what came out. So this, I guess in shorthand, this is what's called a compromise.
I see. Well, also, so let me just continue here. There's got just two or three more of the new rules. Education is not included in the definition of a retirement investment advice, allowing advisors to offer basic information without acting as fiduciaries. And then under the rule, financial advisors may communicate with potential clients before signing a contract, but firms must eventually tell new clients in writing that they are acting in their best interest, and any advice given before a contract is signed must be covered by the contract and meet the best interest standard. So that sounds like an improvement, right?
Yes, but what some people call education, other people can call sales. In other words, you really ought to be in an index fund. You really ought to be in an active fund because, you know, you really need smart people. Well, actually, no. The simplest thing to do is to get a passive fund. And so where this rule stops and says, all right, you can go ahead and tell somebody you know, wonderful things about an actively managed fund as opposed to a passive fund. But when you say, I want to sell you the Fidelity Fund or the Vanguard Fund, that's when you are now limited and you truly have to tell somebody what is in their best interest. So I'm a little worried that, you know, getting them in the door is what you can do without regard to their best interest. Now, once in the door, you have to. But, I mean, you know, getting the guy in the door is two-thirds of the game in sales.
And finally, to give firms more time to adapt to changes, the rule will be implemented in phases. Full compliance is required by January the 1st, 2018. So that's almost 2 years off, right?
Yeah. Well, apparently these companies, even though they're smart enough to know what to invest in each and every day, can't themselves turn around in 2 years. But that is what it is. Washington gets very generous on implementation dates.
So that means they can riff off retirees for almost two more years, right?
Two more years of rip-offs, and then you've got to
behave.
Sober up.
So, in general, though, the problem, I take it, is that Wall Street has all these congressional people, particularly on the banking committees. They own all the Republicans pretty much outright. But the Democrats also want to get on those committees because they get showered with campaign money. And there's an awful lot of corrupt Democrats on that committee, some of whom are African-Americans representing minority communities, who are the worst impacted by Wall Street's excesses. So that's where the rubber meets the road, isn't it?
That's exactly right. This business is able to make lots of money, whether it's $17 billion or $35 billion or $10 billion. It is well worth it for you to spend $500 million, which, you know, $500 million trying to preserve that looting business. And that's, you know, a figure like that has been spent in Washington. And if it takes $1 million to become a congressman, well, then with $300 million, you know, dollars, you can pretty much buy Congress, or at least you can make a big debt. And if it's a complicated subject that would take me or somebody else, you know, 5 minutes to explain, and then you can have some smart-talking person tell the opposite story, that's a perfect issue for a congressman to raise money on if he's not really going to get in trouble back in his district because this is, you know, this is just really too complicated.
Well, Bart, I thank you very much for joining us. I don't mean to rain on your parade, but I guess we should be grateful for small mercies, right?
Yeah, well, I feel like Eeyore, you know, okay, we won. Well, as Elizabeth Warren said today, you know, this is a rare victory, woohoo. So that's where I'm choosing to go to bed tonight. Woohoo.
Woohoo. We won. Well, thanks again, Bart. And again, I've been speaking with Bartlett Naylor, who's a financial policy advocate for Public Citizens Congress Watch and the principal of Capital Strategies Consulting, Inc., which works with progressive organizations attempting to reform public policies where corporations play a key role. Formerly, he serves as chief of investigations for the United States Senate Banking Committee, where he led probes of the savings and loan crisis, corporate takeovers, and insider trading. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether a coal baron will finally face justice. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bob Kincaid, a co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, and the founder of Head On Radio Network, on which she's a regular host. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Kincaid.
Thank you very kindly, Ian.
And today, a federal judge sentenced Don Blankenship, the owner of the Upper Big Branch mine, at which 29 men were killed 6 years and a day ago. He got sentenced to a maximum of 1 year in prison and a maximum fine of $250,000. On the surface, that seems, for the lives of 29 men, that doesn't seem like much punishment. But is this a case where it's better than nothing?
I suppose it has to be, Ian. The fact of the matter is, the fine works out to less than $10,000 per incinerated human being. The jail time will be a year in a minimum security federal facility, let's remember, it's not like they took him away in handcuffs today, to the best of my knowledge. He plans to appeal this case, and the government has filed a motion opposing his request to remain free on appeal. But it's equally sad that, yes, this is a landmark case. This is the first time a coal baron has ever been held in any way directly or indirectly responsible for the financial practices which resulted in the death of more than a dozen human beings, and the loss and heartbreak to their families.
Well, specifically when he left the courthouse, the families of miners that were killed were yelling at him while he and his attorney were speaking with reporters, yelling out, "We buried our kids because of you, and that's all I got is a goddamn tombstone." And then about a half a dozen law enforcement officers surrounded Blankenship and his team and then ushered them into a waiting van. So he certainly he didn't do a perp walk.
No, he didn't. And frankly, we may yet never see that. If the Fourth Circuit overturns this conviction, well, there will be a lot of outrage in Appalachia and hopefully throughout the rest of the country. But not a lot of surprise.
So he was a CEO, of course, Don Blankenship, but four other Massey executives further down the corporate chain were convicted before Blankenship. And the judge, federal judge, said to Blankenship in sentencing him, because she mentioned his rise from, you know, meager circumstances, having a single mother raise him to become one of the wealthiest, most influential figures in the region and in the coal industry nationally. And the judge said, instead of being to be able to tout you as a success story, we are here as a result of your part in a dangerous conspiracy. So that was all they got him on, right? Misdemeanor conspiracy to willfully violate mine safety standards.
That's right. And Ian, we need to remember that that's all they got him on. It's not all that he was charged with, because see, he was also charged with a felony of defrauding shareholders, okay? So let's understand, in the United States of America, it's a felony to try to rip off shareholders, but it's a misdemeanor to dummy up safety regs that wind up with 29 human beings reduced to charcoal.
And specifically, the safety regulations are to do with the buildup of methane that happens when there's coal dust. And there are long-standing means to prevent these kind of explosions. And mine safety investigators found worn and broken cutting equipment that created a spark that ignited the accumulation of coal dust and methane gas. And apparently there were broken and clogged water sprayers that automatically come on to reduce what would be a spark down to, you know, prevent it from becoming an inferno. And they weren't working, and thus you had the deaths. I mean, it's not this is not unusual. These incidents go back hundreds of years, and the technology to prevent them is pretty standard, isn't it?
It's supposed to be, but it also is understood by people like Don Blankenship as cutting into the ability of the coal mine to make a profit. And this is, you know, Don Blankenship is a remorseless coal baron, not the remorseless coal baron. And so the safety regulations are only as good as their implementation. Moreover, the Congress of the United States needs to use the Upper Big Branch disaster, 6 years past now, as impetus to go in and look at these injustices that are manifested inside these regulations. Will they do it? I have no confidence whatsoever that they will.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's a co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and the founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. So when you mentioned a minute ago, Bob, that Blankenship got off the main charges, felony charges, which are about defrauding investors, that's to do with the company Alpha Natural Resources that bought the mine from him after the explosion, right? And a judge has already ruled that Blankenship won't have to pay $28 million in restitution, right, for defrauding them over legal expenses. So is that what you're talking about?
More or less, yes. But there was a complex the felony case was a very complex affair in which the government argued that Blankenship's practices had resulted in financial harm to investors in the company. And of course, at that time, it was still a standalone. It was still Massey Energy. The reason that the judge rejected the plea of or the request of Alpha Natural Resources was because Alpha Natural Resources had not even purchased Massey Energy at the time of the Upper Big Branch disaster. And so the judge held that there was no reasonable or rational nexus between the crime for which Blankenship was convicted and the harm that they sought to be repaid for.
Well, but the point is that not only did the guy get off from serious charges, he got off from paying a real fine, which is $28 million, which is a lot more than the $250,000 he paid.
Right. Well, the $28 million would have been crime victim compensation, and the judge also rejected, I think, 80 on the order of 80 other crime victim compensation claims as well. So, yeah, $250,000 to a multimillionaire like Don Blankenship is chump change, and of course, we get to play the role of chumps.
So, how does this come about? How do you have somebody, and he was a very conspicuous, sort of blustery character who liked to wrap himself in the American flag and parade around and support conservative politicians, etc. So is the protection ultimately in the judiciary in West Virginia, to the extent to which successive governors and legislators have basically turned it into a kind of a tool, if you will, of the oligarchs, as opposed to being, you know, protecting the citizens of West Virginia? That's the impression I get, that to put it bluntly, that the judiciary has pretty much been bought.
Well, I don't know that the judiciary was so much bought in this case, but the history of West Virginia for the last 125, 130, 140 years is one of a government that has been bought. It's a history of government as a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry itself. These disasters, as you noted, are nothing new, and there will be another UBB and another. Part of Don Blankenship's operating philosophy was that if you were attending to safety issues, that you were not making money for the company and therefore not working. There was a previous case at the Aracoma mine in which two men lost their lives where there was just a damning amount of evidence that in that he had in fact micromanaged to the point of making that mine an unsafe hellhole. And when we're talking about a massive blast, a hellhole is indeed what it was, because that was not hell on earth, but hell in the earth. And yes, the government of this state has been bought, but let us not let the federal government off the hook, Ian, because the regulations that he conspired to evade, weak though they may be, are a part not necessarily of state law, but of federal law, and came in with coal mining regulations after the Farmington disaster in the late 1960s, in which a horrifying number of human beings were killed. And of course it's like a game between burglars and cops, with the coal industry in the role of the burglar. To every extent that a safety regulation is passed, the coal company then works hard to figure out a way to make to get around it, because they don't like them, and a portion of our political class doesn't like them, and of our cultural class. I remember years ago, and this may seem a little bit obscure, but a retired football coach for West Virginia University by the name of Don Nealon once declared that we needed to get rid of these coal mining regulations so the United States could mine coal like China. That's real.
Well, I always find it hard to understand the feudal mentality that exists in much of U.S. business, and it's growing in its power and influence. And how do you reconcile that with all of the mythology about this being the land of the free and the home of the brave, and you know, the idea that anybody can pull themselves up for their bootstraps, and this is an egalitarian society? It's always really hard to kind of reconcile the mythology versus the reality. But in terms of judiciary being bought, I didn't mean to say that the federal judge in this case, this was a federal case, she circumscribed. She could do the best she could because the Congress wrote the laws, and it's only a misdemeanor, as you pointed out, to incinerate 29 men. But it's a felony to defraud shareholders. But on the political arena that you just mentioned, you have a Democrat Senator Joe Manchin, and his comments are very hard to understand. It's almost like he can't believe that they put Blankenship in jail, and that he could comprehend the idea that he could be punished. And quoting Manchin, "I never heard of anyone thinking that that could happen or would happen, because it has never happened before." He's talking about the sentencing of Blankenship. What does he mean by that?
I'm not often in agreement with Senator Manchin, but he is merely giving voice to something that has widely been thought in this state, because we have never seen, and that's the one thing that makes this a pitiable little landmark, we have never seen a coal boss be forced to take any sort of responsibility for the horrors that they create. So that's what he's getting at. It's right. Kind of unheard of.
So it's not as if he's objecting to it. He's just thinking.
No. He's stunned because, among other things, when he was governor, Joe Manchin took the brunt of Don Blankenship's wrath on a number of occasions.
Right. So that's what's extraordinary then. I mean, it's even more bizarre, the idea that it's never happened before, that anybody's ever been held accountable. And that means that, you know, people are either resigned to defeat, or is this going to embolden them?
Well, it's sort of like one woman who was interviewed immediately in the aftermath of the blast said, I think CNN interviewed her, and she said, "Well, we always knew that coal mining was a dangerous business." And, you know, there's an element of truth to that, but at the same time, there is, Ian, that resignation that you have touched upon. The coal industry, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, the coal industry runs this state with a somewhat Stalinist fist. The coal industry is not merely an industry. It is treated in this state as if it were a religious orthodoxy. You cannot criticize the coal industry. You cannot criticize coal mining. You cannot criticize what coal does to either people or the environment without risking bringing down the wrath of a significant segment of the population and the power structure of this area.
But what do people think about the fact that it's a dirty fossil fuel that the planet can't abide anymore, and that even Wall Street is pulling away from it, even though they've obviously made huge profits, as has Don Blankenship, and that natural gas is an alternative for generating power, is a cheaper alternative, a cleaner alternative, and it's just like, you know, everybody's in the buggy whip business, you know? So are people, do they understand that? I know it's a tough pill to swallow.
I don't know that they do, because some of those things that you said about, for instance, the planet cannot tolerate any longer the burning of coal, that is deemed to be wild-eyed, radical tree-hugger talk in this state. Now, of course, I'm one of those wild-eyed, radical tree-huggers, I suppose, because I acknowledge science. But we're a very religious state, and people think that if they don't believe in science, that somehow if they are atheistic towards science, which I know is a contradiction in terms, but if they are, that it somehow won't be real. I mean, there's a level of denial and cognitive dissonance here that is absolutely shocking, Ian. And you'd kind of have to be immersed in the culture for a while to really begin to get your head around it.
So the people of West Virginia believe that what Mitch McConnell says, that there's a war on coal, even though it has more to do with reality.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
They absolutely do. And we elected the first Republican dominated legislature in the last 83 years a couple of years back in the 2014 elections, almost specifically on the promise that if we could just get rid of that Obama, I guess that the little Keebler coal elves underground would start making more coal, because it's gone, Ian. In Appalachia, it's mostly gone. And it's not coming back, and people can't fathom that, because they have fed at a carboniferous breast for over a century, and they have no way of conceiving of a world without it.
Well, Bob Kincaid, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
And likewise with you, Bob. And again, I've been speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's a co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and the founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he is a regular host. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.